So it gives me great pleasure to introduce Laura Dresser, who got her PhD in economics at the University of Michigan. Unfortunately, we lured her here to the University of Wisconsin, where she's now the Associate Director of the Center on Wisconsin Strategy, CHOWS. And she's also a senior scientist in the sociology department, and she's an affiliate at the Institute for Research on Poverty at Paulding University, and has done a lot of work on low-wage labor markets, low-wage labor issues. The title of her talk is Economics, Politics, and Movements, Why Inequality Isn't Inevitable.
Thanks, Ingrid. Well, it's a, you know, we're a little crowd. I'm really appreciative that you all are here. I know there are a lot of great other panelists talking now, and so I'm really excited to have you all. It is a smallish crowd, I'm sure mighty in wisdom and spirit, but I tend to actually, even if the room was much bigger, I would want you to interrupt me and talk about what you wanted to talk about, not what I want to talk about. But I think we're almost in a circle. I was wondering if we could quite almost reconfigure so we can all see each other. I have slides. I guess what I'll do is I'll try and fly through the slides, and then maybe we can flip to the circle-ishness and just talk about what it might mean. So that said, let me encourage you to interrupt me if I don't make sense, or if you want me to slow down about something, or if something I say raises a question, I'm happy to deal with questions in the flow. I think I'll try and just get through the slides and then have the, you know, kind of broader theoretical points, or why do it this way, or think about it that way, or what should we do. These kinds of things we'll save to the end, I hope, if that makes sense. And hopefully in all that we'll find good answers to these questions, and you'll be jumping up to answer your questions for reflection and writing throughout, like a game show, really. You'll be putting your answers up whenever you want. I will save it to the end, probably, but I don't mind if you run over with a sticky. Okay, so, you know, and I how many of you are from Wisconsin? Oh, good, because I want to tell you about your state. And how many aren't? Okay, so you get to hear a lot about Wisconsin, and I think it's really important to hear about other states. I've done a lot of research on the Wisconsin economy. What goes on in the Wisconsin economy is very much like what goes on in the national economy. A state lens offers certain sorts of things. I'm going to offer some data on this. I tend to know when it matches national and when it deviates. I may not know your state, but I tend to know the comparison to the national, and often offer it. I also have, when you leave, we do a report at the Center on Wisconsin Strategy called The State of Working Wisconsin. We release it on Labor Day in even years. It's a long report. This is the executive summary. You're welcome to this on your way out. The long report is up on the website, not back from the printer yet. But if you want to read 60 pages, I want to send you the report. So give me a card or something, and I'm happy to send you the report when it's printed. You can also just read it online and save the trees. All right. So I'm going to talk about economics, the economy. I guess also in the context of this conference, I feel like I am talking a lot about what is. I am talking a lot about the economy that we measure, and the economy, and what this economy does and doesn't do, mostly doesn't do for people in the bottom 25%. This conference is about a bigger and a harder thing, about what should be, and most of what I'm talking about is sort of in the economy department is what is. I think that looking forward, you know, partly I think this is just your catalog of the sins and outrages of American capitalism, but I think it is also a reminder of how deeply structural and how deeply interrelated the political and economic spheres and trends that we have are. So I guess one theme I would say to you, yes, this is the economy that is. It is not the economy that this conference and movement aspires to build. Thank God, who would want to build this? But But understanding the way this works matters, and also because of the interaction between the economic inequality we have and the political inequality we have a very hard task and an increasingly hard task of building enough political power to restructure the economy. So that's, you know, another theme here. And now just sort of a pause. Yeah, so the place I work is called the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. We do a lot of interesting stuff. Actually, right now, a project called ALICE, which is supposed to be a little bit of a response. It's a legislative library for progressive legislators. A little bit of a response to ALEC. Think of ALICE, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which is the right-wing infrastructure for state law, really, or part of it, a kind of corporate legislator dating service, as it were. Alice is Alex's sassy progressive little sister, and underfunded at that. But anyway, alicelaw.org. CALS has tried to do many different things over the years. And many of them outside of the state of Wisconsin, but a lot of them in. Our name is sort of a tribute to the state of Wisconsin. And people in the state of Wisconsin tend to kind of like our name and remember it. But people from New York tend to feel very sorry for me. It's just kind of a measure of geography, you know, so we try and do something new, and we have a lot of stuff on our website. We, you know, have a Facebook page. You can like us, and then you would get a little bit of my Laura's Economy Clipping Service, as well as notices on other things that are going on. There's a newsletter that comes out whenever we release stuff. You can sign up for that on our website, cows.org, you know, that's who that is. So probably as you all know, you know that right now we are in the midst of what has been named the Great Recession. It began in the summer, or the December of 2007, according to the committee of dudes who sit around and time things. At NDER, there's a committee, mostly dudes, who sit around and they say after the fact when a recession begins. This recession began in December 2007, but everybody in this room thinks it began in September of 2008 when Lehman went down. That is the kind of, in fact, things were slowing down before that. But on any chart of jobs or pretty much any economic indicator, this is what the last 10 years will look like. You may remember a recession in 2001. We lost jobs. We had a jobless recovery in 2001, running across 2003 and 4. Finally started getting jobs, getting back up to previous levels. And this starts to tip in December 7, and then that's September, October, November, election of Obama, you know, January, February, into 09. That's what this recession looks like, and this is what this recession looks like in jobs, and I think one thing that's important to notice about that is that giant maw of job loss. We are down nationally about 5%, a little less than 5%, state a little more than 5% on our job base from 2007. 5% less jobs, fewer jobs today than we did have in 2007. The population has grown over that period, meaning that at the national level, there's a gap of work of about 20 million. 12 million people who say they're unemployed, 8 million people who under 2007 conditions would have been working, but in these conditions just say they're not working. Right? When you can't find a job for a long time, this is what a discouraged worker is. You look and look and look for a job, and then you say, you know what, I'm retired. You know what, I'm going to be a mom now. You know what, I'm not looking for work anymore. You define yourself out of the labor market. That's what's happened. So what's happened in Wisconsin and nationally. That's a lot of people out of work. And you'll note it's also really crap. This is not much of a recovery. And this is a long time to be 5% down on jobs. The 1980s recession was a brutal one in the state, if any of you remember it. The state had recovered its pre-recession job base within 5 years. We're still a long way off. Also, for you who pay attention to politics in Wisconsin, what is this gap right here today? 240,000 jobs. That's the number of jobs we need to get to feeling like it's 2007. That's our job deficit. We do this report every month when the jobs data comes out. 240,000, that sounds familiar. Somebody aimed at a certain number of jobs. We had a governor who aimed at 250,000 jobs over the course of his term. That was exactly, more or less, the right goal. That is the number of jobs this economy needs to get to feeling like it's 2007. This is all, of course, presuming that what we all need is work and what we all need is growth. Again, these are the big, bigger questions of the conference, but just in this frame, you know, we're way down from where we were, and it doesn't look particularly good. I also, you know, this is employment status in Wisconsin, 2000-2011. The light blue part is the number of people who are employed, the dark blue is unemployed, and the light, the medium blue is involuntary part-time work. What is involuntary part-time work? You know, all of this is off the survey. Some people think unemployed statistics are when you receive unemployment insurance. No. Unemployed is when you say you're actively seeking work. You don't have a job and you're actively seeking work. All right? So if I decide I can't find a job and I'm going to define myself as retired, go back to school, be a stay-at-home mom, whatever, I define myself out, I'm not unemployed. Right? Discouraged workers aren't in there. But people who say they're looking for work, whether or not they get unemployment insurance, they're in there. In 2000, we had about 4% of the population unemployed. By 2011, about 8%. Then on the involuntary part-time status, you get asked about your hours of work. Do you wish you had more if you're in a part-time job, but you can't find it? Sometimes this gets called part-time work for economic reasons, which is like the hardest. My economist head has no way to make that definition make sense. But I call it involuntary part-time work. Anyway, you can see that 5%, in addition to the 8% that are unemployed, another 5% want full-time hours and can't get them. This is I think it's worth remembering that unemployment we treat as a status, but it is a soft economy spreads through everyone's lives, especially at the bottom of the labor market, especially in terms of hours available of work. So I think a lot of people who have a regular contracted job, as it were, a salary position, whatever, you're sort of used to working a certain number of hours. At the bottom of the labor market, you tend to work on the basis of consumer demand. This has been a giant restructuring that we have run in our retail and food and hospitality sectors over the last 30 years. Consumers show up, you get called in. Consumers aren't there, you get sent home. Your hours are contingent on kind of general level of demand. So you get hired in a part-time job or a full-time job, but Walmart doesn't care that much about the category in which you're hired. They care about a customer to check out floor count, and they will manage that on an hourly basis and send people home. So this is to say everybody gets less hours when there's more unemployment. So the folks that were used to getting overtime and making ends meet through their overtime hours that they got in 2007 don't get that anymore. Everybody's hours comes down, not just people going in and out of work status. You can see that increase, but you know all across the board, everybody's position is more precarious. And everybody's position is also more precarious because you know there's a long line at the door, right? It's hard to stand up for yourself to a boss when the boss can look behind you and see the people waiting in line for your job. And so the context changes when unemployment doubles. And, of course, in the classically American way, we concentrate the pain of this recession on the people who have suffered the most over the last 30 years. In the state of Wisconsin, 1 in 4 black workers were unemployed in 2011. This is the worst rate in the nation. So, you know, with Wisconsin, one of the, secrets of Wisconsin, it seems to me, is that Wisconsin regularly posts the worst inequality between blacks and whites of any state in the nation, regularly, on incarceration, on educational outcomes, on child poverty outcomes, income, unemployment. This is one of the unusual events where it's not the disparity, but the level that was worst in the nation. Usually we're worst in terms of disparity. We're not usually worst in terms of level. That's because we're a pretty decent state in terms of white outcomes and a really back of the pack state in terms of black outcomes, and that makes our disparity big. Black kids are 7 times more likely than white kids to live in poverty in this state. That's about the level of Washington, D.C., but no other state gets that bad. But on this one, we were worse in the nation just on the pure level. That's 25%. Another 8% of black workers looking for more hours, meaning that 1 in 3 black workers in this state were under or unemployed, right? A level that was not reached in the Great Depression. A level of economic isolation that would be completely unacceptable if shared by a group that had sufficient political power to do something with it. Also young workers, not so good in this economy. But that's a little bit on race in Wisconsin. This is a little bit on what recovery. This was a recession. How are we all doing? Something? We're okay? Boring. But I'll get through. And then we'll talk. This was a recession, of course, rooted in the housing bubble that blew up in 2007. Gas prices went really high, and the housing bubble blew. That's what happened the summer of 2007. When the housing bubble blows, of course, that wipes out the construction market. You can see that one on here. The construction market falls sooner and falls farther. Manufacturing, yeah.
The construction market include infrastructure kinds of construction or just homes?
Yes, that's both. It's people who identify themselves working in the construction industry, so it's, you know, everybody from housing to commercial.
Are these jobs, the way that they're set up, executive within laws, is it easier than for construction companies to get rid of and lay off people than versus manufacturing or...
The American economy is one of the kind of quasi-regulated advanced economies goes, dropping workers is about as easy as it gets anywhere on the planet here. It's a little bit easier in construction because there is a cyclical nature to that work and a seasonal nature to that work, which means that they have systems of they have much higher use rates, for example, of unemployment insurance. Construction workers in the winter often are on layoff status and get UI. So the flow in and out of work is a little more common in construction because both of the project basis of the work, the fact that workers work across a lot of sites, and because of the seasonal nature of the work. But the fact is that getting rid of manufacturing workers is pretty damn easy, too. When the economy contracts, layoffs are pretty... There's not much that regulates layoffs. In fact, all that regulates layoffs in the United States in a manufacturing plant, and this is very different in other countries, is that there's supposed to be a notice that goes out 60 days before a mass layoff. So if you've notified, you've upheld the law. In fact, a lot of times layoffs happen without that notice, and there's very few teeth on enforcing that. So even that is pretty minimal. All right, so you can see the construction collapse is losing 1 in 4 of the workers, but here's what I'm really focusing on. So you... Oh, look, still falling. There is no recovery in construction. And this is in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, you should know, is not particularly a housing bubble state. The states defined by the housing bubble are Nevada, Florida, California, states with crazy residential housing markets. In the start of the century. Wisconsin didn't have that. We weren't way out of pace. But our construction sector in the last 5 years, or the last, even just the last 2, has been much weaker in recovery than even the national sector. And that is weird and a bit of a mystery. We're clearly overbuilt, but everybody was overbuilt. We didn't have as much bubble to blow, so we don't have as much, we're not like Las Vegas where there's just whole developments all foreclosed and empty. even so, we just don't have any action in the construction industry right now.
Could that be in part because Wisconsin's population isn't growing as fast as the national
average? Well, it's part of the reason we don't have, we didn't have the bubble in the first place. And this is a kind of, I like to make, now that you've made this demographic point, I think this is a sort of useful one to know. Wisconsin isn't growing as fast as nationally. You know this because we lose congressional districts every 10 years, right? You can always tell who's growing and who's shrinking relative by what happens with congressional districts. We lost, you know, and the upper Midwest mostly loses because we don't have a lot of immigrants relative to other states. Immigrants come in, and immigrants have a much lower age profile. So the fact is that people will want to get in conversations about which states have higher unemployment and lower unemployment, and often it is driven by which states have higher immigration and lower immigration. So a higher immigration state tends to have higher unemployment because young people tend to be unemployed more than older people, and because the immigrants tend to be more unemployed than non-immigrants. Anyway, this means that you almost always can say, well, Wisconsin's unemployment rate is lower than the national average, which is true, even though our job gap from where we were in 2007 is bigger. It's because we're older people. It's because we're different people. It's because we're not growing. So all these things move together, just by the way, when you hear that argument. Is that a hand?
I was going to say on the subject of how easy it is to lay off people. An example, where companies have gone bankrupt or declared bankruptcy, filed for protection, I think overdue or unpaid wages and salaries aren't even considered a priority. The banks come first when they distribute what's left in the pot.
This is a perennial issue. When Democrats finally come into the legislature over there, they try and change the order on the bankruptcy to put workers' wages higher on the list. And I think it just always gets lost. But yes, the worker wage is not even in the line, or it's behind the bank in the line, which is like saying not in line. So you can see the construction collapse. You can see the manufacturing. This is the great renaissance of manufacturing. You know, this is the good story of this recovery. This is not unrelated, though mostly unrelated in Wisconsin, to the auto bailout. But you may know that we had a big national debate about the auto bailout. And manufacturing did come back, has come back. It's been the only source of jobs, really, in the Wisconsin economy over the last 4 years. The really steady source of jobs. It's worth noting that that manufacturing base is 3 for every 4 workers that we started this decade with. So yes, we've added 40,000 jobs, and yes, that's most of the recovery that we've gotten in Wisconsin. We lost 150,000 manufacturing jobs. So 40,000 is a small piece of this. This should make you all, in the kind of current debates on the economy, very suspicious of skill shortage arguments in the manufacturing sector. There are 3 workers for every 4 10 years ago. There's also, I don't want to talk about that, but I do a lot of stuff on skills. We also have a fight about data. That 250,000, what was happening to jobs in Wisconsin, actually, let me take you back to this picture, because what we became obsessed with, perhaps you all know, in the last year, was this line, and really the last 12 months of this line, this part of it. All right, so Wisconsin stood out for losing jobs across the last year and a half. This was important because that was supposed to be the highest priority of the governor. And he wasn't actually delivering any jobs. He actually delivered job losses. To date, we are still 4,000 jobs behind where we had the number of jobs we had when he came into office. This is a political issue, especially, and a bit of a political football. To me, I have something to say about data sources. I just think you all should know that whatever you do with a data source here, his data source, which is more reliable because it's slower and more inclusive, comes up a little instead of going down a little. It's all right in here. The only reason we're having the discussion is that the number is so close to zero, using a different series could flip you from negative to positive. When you are creating so few jobs that one series gives you a negative and one series gives you a positive, you should just think you're not creating jobs. No governor should get to go on TV and brag about creating 2,000 jobs a month in an economy of 2.7 million jobs. It's nothing. He made no jobs. There are a number of reasons for that. I don't really think he controls the economy anyway. This was, I think, an early mistake we made to act as if he did. Governors don't control their economies. He controls public sector workers. He controls the quality of my job. The places he most influences the economy, he's done very destructive things. And he doesn't control this economy.
How much of that is loss of public sector jobs?
You know, it's... This is one where the data series really matter, because if you use the one with the slight increase, that shows, so I guess I know the data better from the monthly, about a third public sector jobs, the gap between where we should be if we just followed the national trend and where we are is about 80,000 jobs. About a third of that is public sector jobs, but another third is business services, which is really that in the rest of the nation, temp agencies speeded up hiring, and we didn't have any of that. And the other third is leisure and hospitality. So we've had really weak growth in crappy sectors. It's kind of good news in a way. That, you know, we had good growth in manufacturing. We didn't have any growth in those sectors, but those are the sectors that are leading the national recovery, and Wisconsin is completely decoupled off those. So it's partly public sector, but there's other things going on too.
And I'm sure you get to this later, but whenever we get to national employment of 7.8% or the state rate, if you could touch on the wage growth, maybe we are getting some more wage growth, but it appears to me that this job is preferred also has a number of jobs added which don't have the benefits.
Yeah.
And auto workers being hired at half, close to half their wages.
Yeah.
Well, we're adding jobs, but what kind of jobs are we adding?
You know, a recession makes people, scared and sort of stupid. We get very focused on job counts and very inattentive to the question of job quality or what's going on with job quality in the labor market where jobs already are. So are we undermining that job quality and what's going on in the recovery? I do have a slide on that, so I'll just save that. This is a little bit on, whose data source you use. This is the U.S. recovery. That's the trajectory. This is a completely weak recovery nationally. This is the Wisconsin recovery on the monthly data, which is the data everybody uses. This is the Wisconsin recovery on Walker's data. Either way, we're below the national line. We're about half the national rate of recovery. So, you know, that was all. There's more on that in the state of Wisconsin. Oh, yeah. We lose. I did a friend of mine did a little experiment in football. I talked to the AFL CIO. Made me do a little. Anyway, so I scaled our job growth to, and then scaled other states to our size and delivered jobs to them on the basis of their rate of growth, and we lost every game.
That might be a good slide for people that aren't very, numbers don't come off well to a lot of people.
Right.
But sports do.
Yeah. No, I know. People pay a lot more attention to sports than... I wonder if I should divide it by 1,000, and then it would be scores 37 to 42. It would look more like scores, but then people wouldn't know what it was. I don't know. I welcome anyone.
It's just hard to deliver the information to people that don't understand economics.
Yeah.
Like that. But
yeah.
I don't like that.
Well, I'm glad. I kind of liked it. A friend was doing this. He had sent me the whole Packer schedule, too. So I have it both ways. We win one game in the Packer schedule again.
You pass these out at home games.
What? Pass it out at home games? Yeah. Yes. Well, anyway, anything anyone wants to do to this, to disseminate this, it is yours. You can say you did the math, or you can blame me, whatever you want. But yes, this is on your question about jobs and job quality in this recovery. This is national data, partly because we don't have enough of a recovery in this state to actually talk about the quality of the jobs that are coming back, partly because the state data is hard to deal with anyway. So this is from the National Employment Law Project, NELP.org, and a good friend of mine, Annetta Bernhardt, does this analysis. On the left are jobs lost in the recession, categorized by occupational wage. So higher wage, and I think these are, I have these numbers somewhere else, but I think it's like sort of $18 and above per hour, which is $36,000 a year. Annual income is not a giant wage, but it's above the median. The median for the state and the nation are about $16 an hour. So the top line is $18 or $19 an hour and above. The middle is right around the median wage, so $18 to $14. And this is a lower wage job. This is the number of jobs lost, and this is the number of jobs gained in the recovery. And you can see what you were seeing, and you can see this also in, you know, in if you study people who lose work and where they go back to work, if you talk to people who, you know, have lost hours or benefits at their job, whatever, you can see a downgrading. But you can really see it in this chart. We have more growth in lower wage occupations. Business services, which is a way of saying temp agencies, especially early in a recovery. Leisure and hospitality, food service, and retail are big dominators of that bottom one. We've lost a lot of science and technology jobs in that top category, and we've lost, this is a lot of manufacturing and construction loss, among other things. So that's what this recovery looks like. And it's sort of a bad news picture looking forward. Oops, wrong direction. This also is familiar to you and mentioned earlier, and I think relates to when Garp was talking this morning about, is this a crisis? Well, it's certainly a unique decade. This is the first decade in 60 years where the family income at the end of the decade was lower than it was at the start, counting for inflation. Once you take inflation out, the median family, 4% family, there's all sorts of ways to measure this stuff, and you will see slightly different answers, whether you're doing households, families, or four-person families, but this is the four-person family numbers. But they'll all show the same thing. Income down across this decade and up, you know, basically every decade of the post-war period. This has been a brutal decade for working families. This has been, and I think especially that restructuring at the bottom of the labor market, I think I have some slides about this, but that thing about the the on-call hours of work really has changed at the bottom of the labor market, that retail jobs do not deliver the hours they once did. The restructuring of benefits at the bottom of the labor market is also nearly complete. You have to have a public sector job. If you're going to make $11 an hour or less, the only place, Annie knows better than mine, that you can get benefits in jobs like that is if you get out of the LTE category into a public sector job. No one else gets really meaningful benefits of any sort of health insurance. I mean, you know, we're at the point where, like, getting sick leave, there are many people who never even have sick leave as part of their benefit package. The bottom of this labor market, which is about one in four workers at that $11 an hour and less, is a brutal place to be, not just in terms of the wages you earn and the kind of hard work you do, but also in terms of the kind of hours you can get, the benefits you don't get, et cetera.
Even before the recession, I mean, like the book Mabel and Dime by Barbara Ehrman,
it
was bad even before.
Right. So this is sort of the last decade, but of course, right, what we have is a very long-term shift, and this is the 30-year story, and this is the 30-year gap. This is indexed to 100, you know. So output per hour by 2007 is 3.5 times as high as it is in 1947, right? And the worker wage doubles, not even quite, over that period. And everybody worries that compensation is the issue. Oh, healthcare is really expensive. All right, put in compensation. So that gets you out to, you know, the worker wage doubles over this period. The amount of goods and services we're producing off of an hour of labor, nearly, you know, 3.5 to 4 times. And where does all that go? 400 families. Mm-hmm. You know, stock returns, whatever. That's the picture. That's the underlying picture of the American economy. And I think the longer term problem, and as you know, as he was saying this morning, this is the long term trend that has fed the inequality that everyone essentially concedes to as inevitable. Right? This is the way we've set up our economy. Nobody really debates whether we can change this. You know, they debate the edges around bailout, yeah. Bailout the auto industry, whatever. But they aren't. Kind of nobody's saying, you know what, we need to figure out redistribution in this economy.
Yeah, I was going to say the other problem with this is that what happens is the jobs get skewed more to luxury goods and services that those 400 families can afford.
Right, right. You can see the kind of inequality,
yes.
You know, rippling through in terms of product markets and consumption markets as well. This is the median hourly wage over 79 in 2011. Again, I want to just, you know, this says the same thing the last chart did, essentially. That median worker, but I'm such a geek. I can't put up a graph and not talk about it.
No apologizing. So, that's what we're here for.
All right. Well, geek out with me. This worker in 2011, much better educated than a 1979 worker. Working on a lot more technology, right? With a lot more productive capital. Buck an hour, 3 cents a year over 30 years. That's inflation adjusted. You can see how brutal the 80s was. This is a brutal decade in Wisconsin. Late 90s were nice. Things came up a little bit, but all of this is slow by historic standards, historic post-war U.S. standards. And really flat across the decade. No progress. In wages across the bank. So
this is the picture of poverty wage work. This is work at $11 an hour or less. And it's very, you know, what is a crappy job? You know, you could come up with any definition you wanted, and almost any definition is defensible. My definition is if I worked full-time full year, remembering that hours are almost impossible to get in low-wage jobs, but if I worked full-time full year, could I make enough to keep a family out of four out of poverty? And they get the answer, yes, only if you get to $11 an hour. So that's why I use $11 an hour. It's, you know, at least as good a threshold as any to judge jobs. This doesn't mean all these people live in poverty. If you're the second worker in a household, you might not live in poverty even though you earn poverty level wages, or if you're a single person, you know, you make $11 an hour, you don't count as being in poverty. This isn't a judgment of the income status of the person. If you have a huge family, $11 an hour doesn't get you out of poverty. It's not a judgment of the income status of the person. It's just the quality of the job.
How is that number determined?
The poverty line?
Yeah.
The federal poverty line is a kind of... In the 1950s, there was a U.S. DA economist who wanted to come up with a minimal standard of living. Ingrid could give this talk. Ingrid's trying to get it right. I have an expert on this in the room. And she sort of sat down and figured out, well, people spend about a third of their income on food. I am going to make a minimal acceptable standard, an emergency standard kind of food basket. I'm going to multiply that to make that a third of a budget. I'm going to multiply up to what we need, and we'll index that for inflation from 1950 whatever to today. And I'm going to figure that out for different family structures because they need different amounts of food. And that's where the poverty line came from. It is not a particularly logical way to think about poverty. If you ask people what it takes to live with a family of four, they will almost always say about 2 times the poverty line. What is it hard to get by on with 2 kids? 44,000, people will say. You know, so it is not a kind, you know, 22,000 with 2 kids is really almost impossible. And the baskets of consumption have shifted dramatically. Healthcare costs now ways that healthcare did not cost then. Housing has shifted as well. You know, but that's where that number comes from, that 22,000. So the federal poverty line and the federal poverty statistics are all on the basis of this. And, you know, it's just it's too hot a political potato to ever change, I think. People try all the time because there is not a particularly strong, you know, it really is a little bit of the back of the envelope and really a little bit outdated. And it also doesn't include, I mean, you know, doesn't include the poverty line in Topeka is the same as Manhattan. And also, it doesn't include value of benefits you may receive. So someone who gets, you know, health insurance from a public system, also that doesn't get credited into this either. So there's a lot of things that aren't particularly great, but that's what's from. It's your crash course on poverty.
And ironically, at the start of the war on poverty back in the 60s, the figure was $3,000 for a family of four.
Right. Now it's 22. Yeah. Right. So sense of inflation over time. This is the share of workers earning $11 an hour or less in the Wisconsin economy from 1979 to now. You can see that we have fallen. We are just about 20% in the overall workforce. One in five workers earns $11 an hour or less. I speak almost always, not always, but generally to audiences that spend some part of their life not earning $11 an hour. But there are huge, but this is one in five of the workforce, and this is a career job for many people. I think a lot of people who are in some of my audiences think, oh, I had a bad job once, right? You know, I did childcare, I was a waitress, whatever. I don't have to anymore. And one in five workers earn these wages, and many of those workers earn only those wages over their entire life in restaurants, in childcare, in nursing homes, in retail, cleaning houses, cleaning hotels, cleaning hospitals, all across this economy, careers, lives at $11 an hour. And you can see that that's just not, it doesn't even, it comes down a little in the late 90s. But still, you know, basically one in five workers, one in four, even more than one in four for the African Americans in the state. So remember, one in three African Americans underemployed. Of the ones who have jobs, almost one in three have a job that pays $11 an hour or less. And bad jobs come in bad packages. This is the benefit structure in bad jobs. So if you earn $11 an hour or more, the chances that you get health insurance from your employer, about two-thirds. If you earn $11 an hour or less, one in four. And I've always wondered if I took the public sector out of this, I think it would almost go away. This is reporting that you get health insurance through your employer. This is a pension plan. This isn't even participating in it, just the availability of a pension plan.
Do you mean defined benefit?
No. This is a 401k. Can you throw into a 401k? You know, two-thirds of workers at $11 an hour or more do, one in five workers at 11 or less.
I'm leaving because I've been giving talks about this kind of stuff for 15 years. And you're kind of really appreciating to
the choir's moving on.
Yeah, right.
All right.
And then the other question under health care insurance is what type of benefits. I mean, what type of coverage?
Well, and that's, you know, and I think it's worth remembering that one, right? McDonald's threw a little hissy over Obamacare, saying, if you do this, we will stop offering health insurance. What McDonald's offered as health insurance, any person, any thinking person would think of as reverse insurance. It wasn't insurance. It was help with paying for the first $2,000 of expenses. If you went over that, it was on you. That's not insurance. Well, it might have been five. You know, I don't know that I have the number right, but I have the structure right. That what insurance is supposed to do is protect you when the expense gets big, not ditch you. So a lot of people are reporting yes to health insurance on those terms. You know, that they buy what they get through their employer. They have no idea, actually, until they get sick, the structure of that and the quality of that health insurance. It is a sick system. And especially in the bad jobs, it's bad insurance too. Just quickly on unions, this is pre-Act 10 data. Public sector unionization in the state about 50%. Private sector unionization declining. The next picture of this, if people actually understand their union status and answer it correctly on the survey, I think will show that public sector down at least 30%, and I would guess even more. My sense right now is the only unions that are going to recertify, the teachers' unions systematically are, some of the AFT, the tech colleges are, but and I think some
the attorneys
will recertify. So you know, there's a hand, but you know,
the researchers.
Yeah, the researchers at the state. So some state employees, some small units, small professional type units. But AFSCME has sort of taken a pass, and so that rate will go will fall dramatically in the state, no doubt. But I think it's worth remembering, and it is worth saying that unions are an institutional force that bring or brought a little bit of balance to the political and the economic system. And the lack of unions is about the lack of balance. Those things are completely interactive and chicken and eggish. There's not one that comes first and then the other happens. But when you get to your private sector being less than 1 in 10 unionized, you have no economic power, no ability to take wages out of competition, which is what unions used to try and do in local labor markets. You also have almost no political power, greatly diminished political power. And both of those things are really important in this economy, and we don't have a sufficiently organized non-corporate voice. Labor was that, is that, and still plays that way, but is greatly diminished.
And I think it's going to be a problem, increasingly problematic for unions, if what happens is they keep becoming more and more moribund in the private sector, but remain primarily in the public sector. Is that just going to increase public apathy towards unions?
Well, and this is maybe the amazing thing about Wisconsin in February of 2011. You could not have asked me in January of 2011, this governor is going to go after public sector workers. You know, who's going to show up to defend them? You know, I would have said, you know, maybe some public sector workers. Right? But it is a little bit like wearing a target on your back to be the only workers in the whole economy that still have a defined benefit plan. Right? This wasn't true 30 years ago. Everybody had defined benefit plans. It wasn't a weird thing to want. Nobody has it anymore. So that we don't pay for them, right? Even though the issue of negotiations and wages and compensation come together, you know. But the perception is you don't pay for those. How do you get such a good benefit, right? And it is very hard when the whole private sector is slipping away to have unions and decent work standards in the public sector. They become very vulnerable to attack.
Exactly.
But of course, you know, the inspiring thing was that a lot of people showed up. You know, a lot of people who I never would have dreamt would show up, even from the labor movement. The cross-union solidarity surprised, but probably didn't blow me away. But then to have so many people so far outside of unions at all that were part of what happened in Wisconsin, I think is a...
Well, when you threaten to revoke the automatic payroll, or payroll deduction, that really can wake up the dead people like the union bosses.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Well, right. That one woke them up. But, you know, a lot more people, I mean, I don't think people were there to defend the union automatic withdrawal, right? There was something else going on in what people thought they were defending when they were there. But it was nice to see. This is just the share of Wisconsin students who qualify for free and reduced lunch in school districts in 2000 and 2011. And this, I think, you know, this is my summary graph or picture for you all. And it's, you know, DBI puts these out. They actually have an animated one that takes you through each year to go from that 2001 picture to 2012. But what, you know, what I want you to see from that, and which you already do, is that the public sector, I mean, that the family income has fallen across the state. This is not an urban only issue. This is not a liberal town only issue. This is not only a rural issue. This is across the state. Income is down. Across the state, schools deal with more needy children today than they had 10 years ago. They have less resources to do that. So the families are hurting more. The public sector is drained. The schools are more stressed. And we need to write a different answer. You know, and partly there's a kind of reform, different answer about taxes and the willingness to pay for a society fit to live in. But also there's a kind of longer-term answer about how we're going to answer these questions and feed and live, you know, with each other. So that's that. Yeah?
What are the units on that map? School districts?
School districts. That's for every district in the state.
Okay.
And basically, you know, I know you can't see the percentages, but basically it doubles from about 20 to about 40%, you know, across the board, depending on the district.
I'm guessing it's the same standards for...
Yes. And basically it's 185% of the poverty line is the threshold to qualify in. So another place where we set the poverty line and then we say, okay, but up to 185% of the poverty line, we know you need help. So free and reduced lunch, that's the threshold to get in. So the income status is families at about 36,000 and lower if they're a family of four.
So you could essentially say this is the proportion of children that are going out of households under 185%.
You could almost say that, but there's some caveats, but yes.
So in 2001, was it 185% too?
Yes. It's the same threshold, you know, adjusted for inflation. All right. You know, this is just a quick thing, reviewing things. You know, America's not broke, it's just twisted. You know, and we did this a little bit this morning. Per capita income grew 66% between 1980 and 2010. Oops. Per capita wealth, 73%. Same thing over the next 30 years. But all that...
twisted.
Goes to the very top of the income distribution. You know,
all goes to Waukesha County.
Yeah. You know, here it is. The richest 400 individual Americans have more wealth than half the population combined. You know, and this isn't, okay, let me say this is also not, you know, some people think, well, that's just the way wealth goes. This actually isn't the way we've always done it. That earlier productivity slide shows it. This shows that from 1947 to 73, you split up poor, middle, top. Everybody's income goes up. Sure, the rich get richer, but the poor get richer too. Everybody's income goes up. You look basically since 1979, the bottom quintile sees the left, the least. You know, each quintile goes up a little, tiny bit. Top quintile at 95%, top 1% of 281%. If I could do the top 1% of the top 1%, we would have Madison's biggest building, right? It would be so high. I mean, it just gets more and more concentrated up at the top. But even, you know, the top fifth of the income distribution sees some real doubling over the period. You know,
and I'm sure it's only...
I'm sorry?
Inflation adjusted. Okay, I'm sure it's only coincidental that 1981 was the start of the... drastic slashing of taxes, income taxes on the wealthy.
Yes, it's very hard to know how interactive these things are, but there is obviously a kind of problem.
Yes.
This is going back to 1917. You just see that our level of inequality now matches that preceding the Great Depression. You probably knew that. It's the new Gilded Age. You know, we have a government of the rich, by the rich, and for the rich. Mm-hmm. It creates the redistribution. And, you know, you also know that we're not a high-tax nation. We're a low-tax nation, and we're actually the low point in our tax history. And this is important, you know, in this kind of conversation about whether we're broke. You know, America, as I say, is not broke. It is twisted. And the people who have the money have the power to defend the money. And that means it takes, you know, we're getting more regressive. This is the structure of tax cuts. I'm just ripping through this stuff. Well, that's a depressing list. All right, it's funny that somebody did the Tina thing this morning, because here's my there is no alternative graphic. I use the Monopoly Money guy, if that's familiar to you.
Billionaire for Bush.
Yes, exactly. You know, this is natural and unavoidable, but this is a political issue. It is not an economic issue. Inequality is not inevitably the result of economic growth. It is the result of the ways we have conditioned the terms of economic growth, and that by restructuring what we think growth should do, what we think government should do, we can change what the economy does. But in this context, you cannot do that without power. And you cannot have power in this context. Money is power in this context, but obviously we know the money all sits in one place, most of it. And so you need power, and people are that power. I think this is where I'm going to stop and talk, because we have to say there is an alternative, and you know it starts with us. And so I'm going to stop there.